Ambassador Barco, welcome. We're delighted to have you here, and of course, the Minister of Commerce. It's a real treat to have you here, and I think it is an indication of how important this issue is that we would have your presence. I just spent the last hour and a half. We have a periodic session with ambassadors to look at the political landscape of Washington, and we just spent the last hour talking about the two I's, immigration and imports, you know, and the fear that Americans seem to be having these days of both. Republicans seem to be more afraid of immigrants, and Democrats seem to be more afraid of imports, you know, and it seems to be a pattern, you know. We're very bipartisan. We're paranoid, you know, as a country. And I think in some ways this was a conversation about what will this election be. Will this election be a tipping point of inversion where America pulls back? Or is this going to be an election where we face challenges and come up with creative approaches in government and move ahead? And I think that this really is actually the great challenge that we're facing as a country. Clearly, globalization has produced a phenomenon that we recognize around the world, which is in the more advanced democracies, globalization seems to make the politics more parochial, worried more about things at home. And that's obvious because, you know, the benefits of globalization are so broad, you know, so diffuse. I mean, everybody gets cheaper flip-flops, you know, and you can afford to buy a VCR and this sort of thing. Everybody, but you don't sense that. It's not focused politically. But the price that people pay for globalization is highly concentrated when factories get closed and a community is under distress, et cetera. And so the asymmetry of benefits and penalties especially in modern democracies, is felt quite intensely. And so these two issues, trade and immigration, or, you know, importing people, importing goods, is the paranoia of our time. And the question is whether we have the judgment and the perspective to rise above it. Now, this is brought to a clear focus right now, and I want to especially thank Peter DeShazo for taking this very important look into one dimension of this battle. And it is a battle. I mean, as in all things, there's a lot of debate about what's true. We'll make a decision here, but we ought to make the decision based on honest facts, not on preferences and biases. And I think that what we chose to do here was to try to bring honest facts to the table about this debate. And then let us have a debate. This is the great thing about politics. It lets us take an important issue, put it squarely in front of the American public, and talk about it. But it ought to be grounded in the reality of facts. We have not only Peter DeShazo that's produced this product, and I hope everybody will read it. I think, you know, this is one thing I've learned in Washington is that most people know about studies based on the headline in the Washington Post about the study. Very few people ever read the study. Read this one. This is worth reading. It is a straight, unvarnished look at an important history, a history that we've shared with our two countries, for good and for bad, but it's been overwhelmingly for good. And I think you ought to take a fair and honest look at it. And, of course, we have these very distinguished colleagues today who will add richness and texture. This is a little like color commentary on the Monday night football. I mean, we're going to get color commentary throughout. Solid product and extraordinarily good commentators. So let me say thank you. Peter, let me turn it to you. You will get us going. And thank you all, colleagues. I'm glad you're here. We count on you for being the transmission belt of honesty and factual debate. That's why you're here. That's why we wanted you here, and we're glad you're here. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas Program at CSIS. It's a real pleasure to welcome you all, and thank you very much, John, for your comments and for your forward in this report. This is a report that I think will be helpful in providing background information on an extremely important topic about a very important country and a very important bilateral relationship for the United States. I think as you read the report, and the report is now online, as I mentioned before, so that you have the link to it, you'll find that it covers a broad variety of topics in a serious, nonpartisan way, which is the way CSIS works. And I hope that you will feel free to respond to me and to the other two authors of this report, Tanya Primiani, who is here today, and Phil McLean, who is in San Salvador but is listening by phone. Phil, if you can hear me, welcome, and we're glad to have you with us as well. Very, very pleased to have a very distinguished panel preliminary comments about the report, and then we will answer questions. If anyone has questions, we would be delighted to do that. So let's begin with Mac McLarty, please, Mr. McLarty.
Well, Peter, thank you very much. John, good morning. It's nice to see you, and thank you for your continuing very capable and thoughtful leadership of CSIS and the important work that this organization is doing. And John, thank you for your service to our country as well. In the foreword, Dr. Hamry puts forward, I think, the basic proposition that this is a serious subject about a serious relationship, both bilaterally and from a hemispheric standpoint as well. Peter, I think you and your colleagues have clearly done a very depthful and comprehensive job in objectively, insightfully, fairly looking at the crucial issues not only involving the Colombia FTA, but more broadly, Plan Colombia and the U.S. relationship with Colombia. Ambassador Barco, it's good to see you as always. Mr. Plata, particularly good to have you here as well. I certainly am pleased to be with both Grant and Alec, two people I both like and admire and respect. And I want to note Ambassador Carla Hills's good work on this as well. She's been a driving force on this, as she has been on so many other issues. Three basic points. First of all, there's that line that most of us, if not all of us, are familiar with. Are you better off today than you were at the time of the last election, whether it be 4, 5, 6 years ago? And usually it is difficult for an incumbent, whether it be in a political campaign or an issue-oriented campaign, to frankly defend and advocate and win the day of the status quo for two reasons. One, expectations are usually very high. And two, it's sometimes difficult to demonstrate, to confirm that things are actually better off, if indeed they are. In this case, if you apply that test, I really think by any objective measure, the trend line of Colombia, both from a macro and a micro, a personal daily lives of Colombians, are better off than they were 4, 6, 8 years ago. And I think Alec Watson and others will add some context and perspective to that. But that, to me, is one of the crucial points of this report and the issues that are at stake here. I think the real issue is whether or not that clearly positive trend line progress can be sustained, and can reforms and the strengthening of institutions in Colombia and the lifting of lives, can that progress really continue in the months ahead? The second point, certainly from United States perspective, as you get outside the proverbial beltway, is where the United States has entered into agreements or support foreign aid, have the recipients, have the interlocutors, have our partners acted in a responsible manner? Have they shared their part of the responsibility? And I think in this case, clearly, not only President Uribe and his cabinet, but the people of Colombia have shared in their responsibility in doing what they can do to make their country better, stronger, safer, more prosperous, and fair. I think the elections of 2 weeks ago in the 1,099 provinces or principalities of Colombia affirmed that the longstanding tradition of democracy in Colombia actually was working and deepened and strengthened. What seems to have really happened in Colombia in recent years is the reach of the government has extended throughout the country, and that has strengthened the institutions and the stability of all parts of Colombia. Far from perfect, much more needs to be done. But there's no question that the government, with the support of the United States and a bipartisan effort under Plan Colombia, have strengthened their military, have strengthened their police force, and in doing so have pushed the guerrillas back and out and have gotten control in a much better way of the paramilitaries. You see a decrease in the guerrilla activity, and you see over 30,000 paramilitaries really coming to the table under the Justice and Peace Initiative. Thirdly, I think in terms of the United States, this has been a success story. This has clearly been an example of where real progress has been made by any, I think, objective measure. Again, much more needs to be done. Challenges remain, which I'll note very briefly before Grant and Alex make their comments, and we try to respond with Peter's strong support to your questions. But this has been a success story. And I think that the third point is, what will happen if we don't move forward with Plan Colombia and the Colombia FTA? I think we have to basically ask ourselves, is this going to strengthen and affirm the very tangible progress we've seen? Or if we don't go forward, is it likely that this progress will not be as robust and as meaningful? That's the basic question of the day. So I think Colombia is a complex country. It's not easy to talk about the issues there. It's had a longstanding tradition of democracy, wonderful people, vibrant economy, and yet this two-pronged threat of narco-trafficking and guerrilla warfare have plagued the country for many, many years, as all of you know that have an interest here. And the country is still challenged by those factors and common crime. So I think as we get down to the issues, let me just note some of the progress that has been made very quickly that's outlined in a very comprehensive report. And again, Peter, I commend you and your colleagues because you've clearly done a lot of work here. But both murders and kidnappings are down substantially. You see much more of a focus on human rights and on the critical issue of labor concerns, not only the robustness and really the vitalness of the labor union movement in Colombia, but more importantly, the security of labor leaders. And that is a fundamental issue here. Make no mistake about it. And people can have respectful differing views there. And the question is, how much real progress is the Uribe government making in this area? I think there is now a clear focus. And I don't think there's any doubt, if we are to go forward with Plan Colombia and the FTA, that continued accountability is going to be required to make sure that we are achieving progress in the important area of labor and labor security. But I think in terms of not only the basic stability and security of the country and civil society, you're seeing some real positives in the economy, where you're seeing growth almost 7%. Significant increase in foreign direct investment, which is a sure sign from the capital and international markets that the progress is being made, because capital is a coward. It will go where there's the least risk and the best return, and that is a real barometer. But also you see, in terms of infant mortality, immunization, real important issues at the base level for the human condition in Colombia, reduction in poverty, although not nearly as much that is needed to take place. These are encouraging signs. Finally, Grant can certainly talk with great knowledge about the trade agreement, but I think this is a good agreement from an FTA standpoint. I am pleased to see the Bush administration has come forward with a much more comprehensive view of labor and the environment incorporated in trade agreements. We saw the Democratic vote on the Peru agreement, not unlike the Jordan agreement and the Chile agreement, which Alec and I worked on in past years. But you've had the Andean preferences, which gave Colombia access to our markets. This would make that access permanent. But for the first time, our products will have access to the Colombian market. So just on a pure trade agreement, I would submit that this is good for American business and, more importantly, good for American workers. That is not to say there's not some other issues relating to trade agreements that have to be taken into account, including trade adjustment assistance. But on balance, this is a sound trade agreement. But the issue is broader than that, as all of you know. And again, I think this report addresses those issues in a very objective and depthful manner. Finally, I would just conclude saying that the progress in Colombia, in my judgment, is fragile. It is incomplete. Much more needs to be done. The real question is, what is the best course for us to take at this moment in time to consolidate Colombia's progress in terms of security, in terms of jobs, in terms of lifting incomes? And what is in the best interest of the people of the United States? I would submit that a turnaround has occurred. I think it will continue to improve with our support. Basic security is absolutely crucial to restoring the faith and confidence of the Colombian people in their future. I think they have acted courageously in that regard. Colombia is a friend, a partner, and a neighbor of long standing. And I think it is in our best interest to move forward with both Plan Colombia and the FTA.
Thank you very much. Grant Aldanas.
Well, Mac, that was a wonderful introduction. I'm glad to be here with both you and Alec. And certainly, Peter, I have to say, you know, one of the great things about being at CSIS are the colleagues I get to work with, and the quality of the work that gets done here is just amazing to me. Like Jan said, I commend the report to you to actually read it, in part because the way it's done and the thoughtfulness of the approach, but also because it's a very nonpartisan look at the facts. And I have to say, in our political context these days, the facts are the first casualty, oftentimes, of the political fray. But the facts are important. They're hard, uncomfortable things, oftentimes, in a debate. But here, the facts are almost universally positive. Mac's point is right. It is fragile in Colombia. It is something that deserves our support, merits our efforts on our behalf, but the report really speaks for itself in terms of what it details about the progress in Colombia. I want to make three points, basically, in reflecting on the report. The first one's political, about the context, more in Latin America than here in the United States. The second one is economic, which you'd expect from me, and then the third thing is moral, which is important, and it was oftentimes forgotten both in our political debates here as well as in our foreign policy, but I want to drive that point home. On the political front, what strikes me, of course, as somebody who is basically focused on Latin America from my earliest days in the Foreign Service throughout my career, is what Colombia has always represented. Colombia has always represented a strong, stable supporter of the values we cherish and certainly the values that we hope for the region. The most recent decade, the decade of the 90s, had been an aberration in Colombia's history. It's not what we saw in Miami Vice. That wasn't Colombia's long history. The reality of Colombia was very different. And why that's important is that throughout the region, folks are watching Colombia. As we've seen a shift in politics in Latin America, one that I expected and one that I, in fact, welcome in many respects, as we've seen a different sort of relationship evolve with the United States, everybody in the region is watching what happens in Colombia and whether Colombians succeed for themselves, but also will the United States actually support Colombia in that effort. That's important. It's critical, in fact, in terms of our broader relationships within the hemisphere. So the contextual point I want to make is that everybody's looking over our shoulders, everybody's looking over Colombia's shoulders. The other point I want to make about the political context is this is an effort that's been made by Colombians. You know, we have the great benefit in the United States in our splendid isolation many times of thinking of everything revolving around what we do here in Washington. The reality is quite different, of course, as we all know, on the ground. This is an effort that has been accomplished by Colombians. Yes, with support from the United States, remarkable bipartisan support, great leadership, from Mac and Alec and from the Clinton administration on Plan Colombia, one of the, I think, great success stories of the Clinton administration's foreign policy. But the reality is it had to get done on the ground, and the real heroes are in Colombia. And the question is whether we're going to vindicate that in terms of our relationship with Colombia as well as throughout the rest of the region. On the economic front, I have to say, it's not just that in 1999 GDP fell by about 5% and the financial crisis that came home to roost in Colombia essentially had devastated the banking system. Capital markets, we all know, provide the grease that allows the rest of the economy to work, and that basically had shut down in Colombia. Now, that's important in the context of Colombia to see that it is now a country that's growing by 7%, well above the mean for the region, above the mean internationally, significantly above the mean internationally. Investment is flowing in. It's becoming a destination for investment. Certainly, it has been one of the long-time adherents in terms of trade rules and the trading system, all those sorts of things, again, that Colombians have done on their own, with support, yes, again, for the United States, but on their own. The broader point I want to make, though, is remember, during this decade, the winds of change that have been blowing through the entire global economy have been significant. And the reactions we see on a political front on trade issues in the United States reflect those changes. What's interesting about it is Colombia succeeded not only given its own circumstance, but succeeded in a world that is rapidly globalizing. In other words, it has figured out the things it needs to do on the ground, both at a macro level in terms of encouraging stability and a micro level in encouraging enterprise and in encouraging trade and connecting people in Colombia to world markets, which is the essence of economic development. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's not trade and development. Trade is development. And ultimately, the goal has to be to find a way to link individuals in your society to markets. And that's what Colombia has done. The FTA, rather than looking as some signal event, confirms what Colombia has done rather than creating some new initiative. Frankly, it's Colombia's great efforts to try and connect its people to markets that have led to the economic success it sees right now. So when I look at the FTA, I think it's critically important for us to pass it. But I want to underscore, as somebody who's looked at this for a long time, is this is confirming what Colombia has already done in its own interest. And again, I want to remind everybody that people in the region are watching to see if Colombia succeeds economically as well as politically. The last point I want to make is purely moral. And this, I think, always gets lost. And I worry about my own country when we lose sight of this fact. But I don't want anyone to escape this room or anywhere else when we get a chance to talk about it to understand that it is our demand for narcotics that has led to a lot of the devastation throughout the region. And when I think about our obligations as a country and the support that we owe our friends in terms of trying to address the fallout from the demands in our society, I think it's time we stepped up across the board, whether it's Mexico, and I applaud the Bush administration's recent support. But here with Colombia, we're talking about something that is a major success story in terms of trying to recover from the devastation that was visited on the region, largely by demands in our economy, for people who largely escaped justice in our system. If there is any way that we can respond in a way that tries to right the balance of equities in this system, I want to be on that side as a part of it, whether it's on the trade account, whether it's politically with Plan Colombia, but ultimately that's where America should be. If we're consistent in support of the values we believe in, then ultimately we ought to be consistent in our support for what Colombia has tried to do on its own behalf. That's one of the reasons why I'm really thrilled by the report, because what it does is vindicate what Colombia has done on its own, really to succeed in spite of the challenges that our own demand for narcotics create, that the economic changes in the global economy create, and most of all, the difficulties of trying to ensure that they've preserved democracy under very difficult circumstances. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Grant. Alec?
Thank you, Peter. It was fun for me to be participating a little bit in this report, although not as an author, certainly, because that's the great work you and Phil and Tanya did, but as sort of the coordinator of a bunch of us that, you know, give our comments to the writers, and then they did with them as they wish. I want to take a slightly different approach from Mac and Grant and focus a little bit on the historical context of what has happened in Colombia over the last couple of decades. I think this is a very thoughtful and carefully documented report. One of the things I was impressed about is how carefully documented it is. Those footnotes are really good. It gives you an idea of where the data is coming from. So if you want to challenge the data, you can go back to the sources. I think it's a really valuable contribution to the ongoing discussion in the U.S. and elsewhere about Colombia's current reality and the historical conditions from which it evolved. The report draws on a very wide range of sources and viewpoints and provides good background for the serious analyst and policymaker. As Grant suggested, it is especially valuable because public discussion of Colombia from different perspectives, tends to be highly polarized, advocacy rather than analysis, in which facts sometimes take a back seat to opinion. This report certainly does not pull punches in terms of its description of the horrors of the past in Colombia or of the current challenges facing Colombians. Yet it provides a sound understanding of their historical context and the provenance of these challenges, their profound and deeply rooted causes. And it offers a clear description of Colombia's positive evolution over the past 8 years on a broad variety of fronts, as Mac has pointed out, since the country's nadir in the late 1990s. Now, when I lived in Colombia more than 20 years ago, I was the deputy chief of mission, the number two guy in the U.S. Embassy there. That country was already infected with the diseases which would prove almost fatal 15 years later. Most Colombians, I would say, were in denial, however, and even we brilliant diplomats did not discern how serious the problems were and how deep and rapid the degeneration would be. There was widespread violence in the countryside perpetrated by powerful political chieftains and also by leftist guerrilla groups of various stripes. Violence that really began at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, as the Peters report points out, described so well by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for instance, and then rekindled by the Bogotazo in 1948, and then fueled subsequently by Cold War passions that were infecting the world at the time. In Colombia, extortion was commonplace and kidnappings were legion. I can remember several friends of mine, Colombians, were kidnapped during the 3 years that I lived there. I think all of them managed to be released finally, but not without significant cost. There was a weak, decentralized state dominated by two political parties that had alternated power, which reduced violence at the macro political level, but which didn't. These parties did not really address the underlying issues in Colombia. The narcotics industry was just beginning to blossom, as Grant points out, in response to demand largely from this country, although elsewhere, but largely from this country. First, there was marijuana. The older people in this room may remember Colombian gold, maybe even when you were in college. That was the fiesta de resistance of marijuana back then, from the North Coast. from the North Coast, largely, in the Santa Marta region was largely where it was grown. Then came the manufacture of cocaine, and based on coca grown in largely in Peru and Bolivia, and then the increasing cultivation of the coca plant itself in Colombia. Flamboyant drug traffickers strutted about. Pablo Escobar used to wander around holding up. He was an alternate member of Congress. He had carried around his passport, showing his U.S. visa to the TV cameras like this. You had Carlos Leder, who made a statue of John Lennon in his hometown of Armenia. You had Rodriguez Gacha, and you had the Ochoas with their many ranches and all their African animals they imported to make their zoos and things. These were public figures. They were considered to be Robin Hoods, but they were ferociously violent among themselves and against the society. And I guess I felt that most personally when a very good friend of mine, who was the Minister of Justice, Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, was murdered after being one of the few Colombian public officials to take a real stand against narcotics traffickers. He understood better than anyone else at that time the seriousness of this problem. And they gunned him down on his way home one evening. The motorcycles, the sicarios got him when he came home. There was a climate of fear in the country. The military refused to take on the drug traffickers in those days for the legitimate fear of having their troops corrupted by the traffickers. And then there emerged the beginnings of links between the narcotics gangs and the leftist guerrillas. Most people forget this started with the M19 and the marijuana guys. They were working together to move marijuana out of the north coast of Colombia through Mexico, even through Cuba, into the U.S. Then came Tranquilandia. Most people here probably never heard of Tranquilandia, but it was a huge cocaine laboratory down in Guaviare that was discovered in the mid-'80s, and it was guarded by members of the FARC. That was the first time, to my knowledge, that we had any evidence that the FARC and the drug guys were in league together. Then the formation of the private gangs of gunslingers to protect ranchers and others, including the cocaine traffickers from the FARC and ELN, as well as others. And then these gangs ended up gravitating to direct involvement in the drug industry as well. So these cancers from right and left were destroying already weak state institutions, the police, the judiciary, Congress, the executive, provincial governments. The public and the governments were in denial about drug trafficking. It was described as an American problem at that time by many Colombians, at least to me. Unable to defeat the leftist guerrilla groups, governments tried peace negotiations, but these almost always came to naught. And this, mind you, was before things got bad, before the cataclysmic deterioration that the CSIS report describes so well. My point here, and I think the CSI report makes this very well, is that to understand and evaluate the current situation in Colombia, an objective analyst must comprehend this history, this political and social context. We must grasp how close to the brink, to use the report's term, Colombia came and how far it has progressed since then. Today's problems are great, certainly, but they pale beside those of only a few years ago. Yet many of the factors that drove the deterioration remain, and as Grant pointed out, and the recent progress is certainly not irreversible. The U.S. and other international actors played key roles in helping Colombia achieve the progress it has made. It is clearly the U.S. obligation and in the U.S. national interest to determine thoughtfully what we can do to help avoid a reversion in this reporting country to the horrors of the past, and how we can help Colombia overcome the problems it faces today. And I think this report will help us do that. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks very much, Alec. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. I hope you you enjoy the report. Please feel free to contact me if you have any questions about it.